Hello and welcome to Travel Genius. I'm Mark Elwood.
And I'm Nikki Eckstein. We're the Travel Geniuses.
Yes, we are. This week, we're playing Santa Claus and we're going to give you the greatest holiday gifts, we promise, we possibly can. Survival strategies to make sure your winter travels go off flawlessly.
Plus, we'll be joined by best-selling author Tilly Bagshaw, who travels so often between her homes in California and London, she's basically a transatlantic commuter.
All that and more on this week's Travel Genius.
So, Mark, first things first, what do you have on the docket for your holiday season travels this year?
I have to say, Christmas wouldn't be Christmas for me if I weren't in London. So I am flying back to London, and it feels like Christmas starts the moment I get on that plane. Daytime flight to London, I have a morning cocktail, and I just feel full of figgy pudding and Britishness.
Oh, figgy pudding is one of my favorite things. But wait, daytime flight, I always do the overnight flight.
Oh, morning flight's the best flight. It's always the cheapest because people who are on vacation don't want to pay an extra night at a hotel in New York. So it tends to be emptier, easier to get a better seat.
That is super smart. Mark, if I could ding you now, I would. I'm staying local because, kind of like you, this is just what I do every year. I love it when New York empties out for the holidays and you get it all to yourself. And anyway, I celebrate Hanukkah, so Christmas is not a time that I need to be traveling and getting stuck with all of the thousands of people in a TSA line. I can just relish in like the quiet, beautiful, strong lit romance that is New York.
But the people who are traveling at Christmas last year, this is an incredible statistic. Think about it. 107 million Americans, or people from America, I guess that would count me, traveled between December 23rd and January 1st. That's basically a third of the country.
It's insane.
Got on the move.
Yeah, so that number has grown every year for at least the last 5 years. And that makes me think that a lot of the people that are listening right now are right about ready to pack their own suitcases and get out of Dodge.
You know, and they're thinking about those security lines, getting the presents confiscated, unwrapped by the TSA, dealing with snowstorms. One little tip I will say, if you are taking a snow globe through security, you can take it through as long as it's smaller than 3 ounces. Because
snow
remember,
globes.
It's a liquid. But it's allowed if you can fit it into your toiletry bag.
Well, on that theme, we are playing Santa today, definitely not the Grinch. And I have to say, there's a lot of things that people can do to make sure that their holiday travels go off without a hitch. There's so many different pain points, especially this time of year with the weather being what it is. But gifts are definitely one of the things that people are always wondering. How do I make sure that I get, you know, whatever I've bought to my relatives that I've bought it for? And I will say, don't wrap before security. If you must, put it in a bag so that security can unwrap it without you being totally distraught about it. And if you can wait until you land, wait until you land. Because if the TSA can't figure out what's in your box, they will open up your luggage.
And they're entitled to open up your luggage. And whatever rules and regulations you quote at them, they will simply say, I'm allowed to use my discretion. So remember, if they want to rip that package open, there's nothing you can do.
And they
stop
can
them.
Do it without your being there. This can happen with your checked luggage, too. So don't assume that just because you're putting a wrapped small box in your checked luggage, that it is safe from being unwrapped and investigated. That is false.
The other thing that we would always talk about is known traveler number. In other words, you want to make sure you can get TSA pre-check so you cut those lines. Does everyone you know have pre-check, Nikki?
A lot of people do, but I'm surprised to hear that some of my friends still don't have it. And I can't really understand why. It's very it's affordable. It lasts a long time. It's $100 for 5 years. It's some of the best money I've ever spent. But if you are one of the people that doesn't already have PreCheck, and by the way, if you do have PreCheck, just make sure that your reservation has that stupid number on it, because paying for it and not getting it is the dumbest mistake.
Check
and
it.
I've done it.
Check in. I've done the same thing.
I've done it.
You'd be surprised. If you're flying internationally, a lot of international airlines now cooperate
yes.
with TSA PreCheck. But say at check-in, could you check that my known traveler number is in there? Because unless it says TSA PreCheck on that boarding pass, you will not be allowed
you're
to use
stuck.
That line.
But I will say, if you don't have PreCheck, get PreCheck. If you don't have it, Clear is a really good alternative that is becoming better and better, particularly if you're flying domestically in the U.S. And the reason that I like it, it's not as ubiquitous as PreCheck yet, but You can sign up for it in the airport in literally 30 seconds.
So I get, as a Delta Diamond, one of the nice things Delta gives me for my loyalty is a free Clear membership. And it discounts Clear membership for certain medallion status levels. And I was very blasé about that freebie. And I also did the sign up after a very long flight. So I look like hell in the picture and it comes up every time. But it is... In JFK, for example, it doesn't usually shave off that much time. But at certain airports, I've used it at LAX, and you are essentially pre-checking the pre-check line.
It's amazing. There are airports I fly out of Miami International quite frequently, and that airport tends to get very backlogged for pre-check. And so if you are in that situation, you can look for the Clear line. If the Clear line is totally empty and you're rushing to get onto your plane, Clear literally takes like 30 seconds to sign up for.
And they escort you to the front of the pre-check line and you just wave at the people who have pre-check and look like you're apologetic and then just cut right in.
It's kind of amazing. And then, okay, so let's talk also about flight delays and cancellations, because this is something that affects everyone, no matter what. It's out of your control when it affects you. And in fact, these are tips that I had to put into play over Thanksgiving when my brother-in-law's flight was delayed and delayed and delayed and ultimately canceled. Here's how you play that situation for what it's worth. If you start seeing those delays stacking up, and granted, you can start looking before you even go to the airport, figure out what your plane is, like which plane you're getting on and where it's coming from.
So I always use FlightAware for
that. That's the app.
So if you put your flight number into FlightAware and you click through, there'll be a little button and it will say, where is my plane right now?
Exactly.
So even if there is no delay posted on your flight, if you see that the aircraft you're about to ride on is 3 hours late arriving, you know ahead of everybody else,
something's going on. So that's exactly right. We're so simpatico on this, Mark. And what you can do is if you see that that delay is likely to really stack up, in my brother-in-law's case, his flight started getting delayed because there was a mechanical problem on the plane and they had to put a fully new plane into service, fly it over from another airport to get to the flight that was coming to then pick him up. It was a whole situation. And I saw that that was the cause and I said, that flight ain't leaving tonight. And
she's waving her pencil around in a very scary way. I feel like I've done something wrong.
I told him to call the airline right away and get rebooked preemptively. And this is something that airlines will do for you if they agree with you that those delays are stacking up in a way that looks kind of tenuous. And you tell them that you're doing them a favor. Mm-hmm. You're getting an angry customer off of their back now instead of later when they have 300 of them to rebook. And you tell them to waive your change fees.
And they will want to waive your change fee because you are doing them a favor.
You are.
You are not asking inappropriately. But if you don't ask, the system may well automatically apply it.
Correct.
Now, if you've got a good proactive reservations agent, they'll probably be nice to you. But remember, don't be afraid of asking and saying, hey, guys, I'm kind of helping you out here. I presume you're not going to charge me anything.
And look online before you make that call. See what seats are available the next day. Figure out exactly what you can ask for so that they don't automatically put you on the 6:30 a.m. flight. And if they tell you that there are only seats available in first class, then you know what you can do. You don't have to tell them, give me the free upgrade, although that would be nice. It's unlikely to happen, but you can tell them, upgrade somebody else on the plane who's a frequent flyer, who deserves that upgrade, and give me their coach seat.
I think it's very smart to think that way and realize that the real focus is getting where you want to get as quickly as possible. Sure, the comfy seat is great, but if you're in that bind, admit that an economy seat on the way there is better than nothing.
Yes, absolutely. And last thing I would say is download this app called Lounge Buddy, which will get you into the airport lounges if you are going to be delayed, but you're going to wait it out. Because that way you pay, $25, maybe $50. You're in a quiet place in the airport. Sometimes you get an open bar. The app is actually good about telling you what amenities are at each lounge that you can get into. And that way, at least you retain a little peace of mind.
I would also say, if you pay, I would defer always to paying for entry to the lounge of the airline on which you're flying, if it will allow it. Because the customer service agents in that lounge, if there's chaos outside in the terminal, you're essentially getting a couple of people dedicated to a smaller number of what are perceived as premium flyers. So if you're in that airline's lounge, you're away from the chaos and you've also cut the line.
Yeah. So these are just all things that you should keep in your back pocket before you head off on your Christmas travels, just to make sure that you do indeed have the merry, merry holiday that you all deserve.
You know, talking of merry holidays, we're going to bring in someone who is human Christmas, I would say. This is a friend of mine I've known since I was 18. She's the embodiment of holiday spirit, a little bit of figgy pudding in human form. But she's also a best-selling author. Her name is Tilly Bagshaw.
Her first book came out in 2005, and it's a Jackie Collins-style bodice ripper. Since then, she's written several more books in the same vein, as well as a couple other ones under the name Sydney Shelton, a name that she was authorized to use from his estate. Today, she's joining us from her home in Los Angeles. All right, Tilly, thank you so much for joining us, and welcome to Travel Genius.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, Tills, before we dive in, there is one procedural rule you're going to want to know about. Since you are on Travel Genius, okay, brace yourself for this. We really want some genius tips from you. So whenever you give us one, you will hear a sound.
Oh, no. Okay.
That's a hotel bell, which will mark truly genius things. And no pressure, but Nikki, who's the adjudicator?
I am.
Okay.
You only have to impress her. I'm just here to settle any disputes. If you feel like you didn't get a fair point, appeal to me.
Okay, got it. I will. Fingers on the buzzers.
Yeah, very scientific methodology over here, just so that you know. Well, Tilly, let's dive in. You are a devoted miles flyer, and we know that you commute between your homes in America and Britain a whole bunch. You've got a secret trick up your sleeve. I know that you're an airline maven, and I am obsessed with your tricks. So why don't we dive right into something that I already think is pretty genius?
Which is, when we fly on Virgin Atlantic, we're trying to always get seats upgraded for miles, which is not always easy because we travel with a small traveling circus of children and friends and nannies. And
how many people are you all together?
Sometimes we are seven, sometimes we are six. We're always at least five.
Wow.
It's a decent group moving, and it's an expensive group. So we're always trying to get upgrades if we can, and we usually do have a ton of miles, but there's not always seats released. So we started doing something that another friend recommended to us, which is, rather than just go through Flying Club, or when you're talking to Flying Club, my husband would say, because Flying Club would say, oh no, we don't have any seats available for miles.
And Flying Club, just for people who don't know, remind it, Flying Club is just the Virgin America.
Flying Club is just the Virgin Atlantic, the sort of customer service.
Exactly.
That you get the little card, the thing that does the miles and that where you can book tickets and get upgrades and whatever. So you would call them normally to see if you can get an upgrade, and they would say, no, you can't, because there's nothing available on this flight for miles. And then you would say, that's strange. Why haven't revenue management released any seats? Or could you put a quick call through to revenue management and ask them when they're going to release the seats? Because we see that there's space on this flight or whatever it is. And basically, you drop these two words, revenue management, and then they would go and say, oh, well, I'll see what I can do. And the next thing you know, boom, there are seats, and seats are released, and we can book them, and you can get upgrades for miles. So we did this every time we flew for a few years, revenue management. I don't know how it worked or why it worked, but it seemed to sort of mark you out as somebody who knew that there was, in fact, a whole nother layer of people behind Flying Club whose job it was to make sure that these flights run at a profit and that their seats are full.
How many times have you had success with this?
Every time. I mean,
every time?
Yes. I guess we haven't used it in the last year, but up until last year, whenever we would go on Virgin, that's what we would do. Whereas before, maybe one time in two or three, there'd be enough seats available for miles. Suddenly, once we started using this, they were.
You got a ding for that, Tilly.
That was
a genius point. What I would always say, the point you're making is very well made, in the sense that there's something called load factors, which airlines have people in charge of, and they're looking to maximize their revenue on a plane. When there are mileage seats on planes, they will be released at different times according to what the algorithm says. And I've always found, for example, if you book a premium economy miles seat 3 months out, 3 days before the plane takes off, if you double check, you might well be able to then book a very cheap business seat instead of that one. So when mileage seats are released always depends. And I think what you're saying is, nudge them into releasing a mileage seat. They check on the computer and they might well do it.
Yeah, I suppose that probably is what's going on behind the scenes. You know, is your experience of it just as a regular punter is there weren't any seats and now there are. So it was magic. It was filed under M for magic for us in our family. But now I fear that I've done the terrible magician's thing and told my magic trick. So I don't think I should answer this question anymore.
I do want to ask you about something else on planes, though, because I know, like many of our listeners, I'm sure, you were or are a bit of a nervous flyer, but you've learned how to handle the long flights with a sort of technique you learned via your son. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, actually, I'd love to talk about that because it's sort of a bit miraculous because I have been, for a long time, most of my adult life, I've been really a properly terrified flyer. I've never not taken a flight because of it, but I have many times wanted to. I've many times been taking off sort of with uncontrollable shaking of the legs, chattering teeth, the whole thing. If my children aren't with me, I'm always in tears, or I was. And I tried absolutely everything to handle that and push that back. I read all the books about safety and none of it helped that much until, I learned this technique that I learned for my son, who was had a lot of anxiety for other things. And it's called realistic thinking, which is it's sort of a bit like positive thinking, but more truthful, I suppose. And it's where you tell yourself in actual words in your mind. So say if the plane starts going through turbulence, you tell yourself, every time I've ever been on a plane, this has happened. And every time this has happened, I felt the way I'm feeling now with racing heart and everything else. And every single time, it's always come to an end and ended peacefully and nothing's ever gone wrong. And you literally, even though you know those things, you have to sort of say them out in sentences in your mind over and over, like a sort of mantra. And in the end, by sort of ramming this rational thought in the space of all your irrational thoughts, you bring your fear down. And it is amazing. Over time, it really has worked. And I would say my fear of flying has gone down probably 70%, maybe more.
Another bell. That's
another
two for two.
That's two for two. I've just never heard of this, but it's, you know, they talk a lot about fears and ways to cure fears. And I think that most of the traditional ways to cure fear seem either especially cruel or really impractical to do on a plane. And I know so many people who are nervous flyers who I think could do this very easily.
Yeah, it's an easy one. Doesn't require anything extra. And you carry it over to other sort of aspects of your life. I remember flying back from Canada and there was a beautiful sunset as we were coming down over LA. And I remember looking at it, thinking how beautiful it was and thinking, gosh, you know, this would be a really nice experience if you weren't terrified. And and it is, you know, flying is amazing. It's beautiful. It has potential to be an incredibly moving and lovely thing. But you have to be in control of your own thoughts. And it's sort of the one thing you can control when you're up there.
So I want to take us back down to the ground. So let's get out of 30,000 feet. We're totally feet on the ground.
Right.
And I know you're a big fan of train travel, but you also, people probably need to pack something they don't realize on every train trip. Tell me about you, how you learned to love train travel and what everyone should bring for their bruises.
How I learned to love train travel and what one should bring? Well, I do love train travel, and I think I've always had a sort of romantic sort of fantasy about it, if you like. According to my parents, I was conceived on the Orient Express. I don't know if that's true, but that is a story they have long told.
Or
at least on a trip where they took the Orient Express, either to Paris or Venice or somewhere. They won it for something. They did some competition in the Times to do with puns, and they won a trip on the Orient Express. So maybe, I don't know, maybe that implanted it, or maybe it was my son's obsession with Thomas the Tank Engine. But I love that old, the romance of steam travel and steam trains and old trains. And we once did go on a truly incredible trip. It was after I'd finished having all my babies. And we took the Orient Express that goes from Singapore to Bangkok. So it goes all the way through Malaysia. It's just the most incredible journey and the most incredible train. You feel like you're in Downton Abbey. Everyone dresses for dinner. The cabins are all these beautiful sort of 1930s mahogany desks and lovely writing paper. I mean, it was my idea of heaven, absolutely. But I was very pleased that I took the advice of a friend of mine who'd done this journey before and packed Arnica cream, which is for bruises. Because as lovely as this train was, it's going on these tiny little single track, you know, narrow gauge tracks. And it rattles and rattles around. I mean, like, absolutely like nobody's business. So you've got a little shower, in fact, in the cabin on this train, which is quite amazing in itself. But it's pretty tiny, and you step into this shower, and boom, you're slammed against the wall. As soon as you step into the corridor,
you're
slammed against the door. So there was a lot of bruising under our lovely evening dresses, and the arnica came in handy.
So pack ball gowns and bruising cream.
Yeah, ball gowns and bruising cream for a trip through the Malaysian jungle on a steam train.
Yeah,
I don't know how much of a relevant top tip that is to your listeners, but it worked for us.
Both to cover you up. We've covered air travel and train travel, and we've also covered the fact that you tend to travel in a big brood. Talk to me a little bit about how you do just plain old land stuff and what that means for you with hotels. Are you an Airbnb person with your big family? What's your general strategy?
Right. I mean, so to that, 100% yes. I mean, Airbnb has really transformed our lives. I would choose Airbnb over a hotel. If I'm with the kids, I would choose Airbnb over a hotel any time. I still think there's something wonderful and magical about hotels for the romantic experience for the two of you. But with kids, no way.
Have you done hotels with kids?
No, it's a nightmare. I've taken some lovely hotels and we have had some lovely holidays. But now that Airbnb exists, now that you have an option to be living in a sort of home environment where hopefully another family's home, which is set up for kids of whatever ages your kids are. In fact, I had dinner with a girlfriend last night who just got back from an incredibly expensive trip to Hawaii, but she'd managed to book the quote unquote wrong house where, you know, she has toddlers and there were sort of sheer drops and cliffs and open water. And, you know, it was a beautiful romantic house, but it just didn't work. And I think hotels generally are not set up to work for small children and young families. And Airbnb can be whatever you want it to be.
So how do you vet your Airbnbs to make sure that they work for your kids? I mean, to make sure that if you're going somewhere, let's say in Southern California, that there's proper fencing around the pool or that the cabinets have child locks or whatever it might be that's important to you.
I speak to that more from the other side because we're also landlords with Airbnb. I let out my house in California and my house in England and we have a property in Nantucket that we rent out. So as landlords, we answer all these questions and we always make sure that we speak to any tenants that are coming. We know some information about them. They know stuff about us. We know people pretty well before they're coming into the house and that works both ways. So I think it can be whatever you want it to be. It can be very anonymous and distant if you want, but I strongly would advise anyone traveling with a young family to ask to speak on the phone and be like, right, I've got a 2-year-old. This is the deal. You know, where are your baby gates? Where are your stairs? All those boring questions that you only know if you're in that stage of life, you you have to ask and be very specific.
I was going to say, talking about travel tips, as an Airbnb host, because I'm sure we have some listeners who've mulled doing that, what do you wish someone had told you, first of all? I remember being told that the way to juice your ratings on Airbnb is you make sure that you underprice significantly for your first 6 months. So everyone raves at what a deal they're getting. Hmm. And then you jack the price up to what you always intended to charge and you have an awful lot of top ratings. What do you wish you'd
That might be true.
Sorry, Mark. You get a point there.
I got a point.
You
Goodness
got a point.
Me.
You do. I like that.
Yay.
No, that might be true. I haven't heard that specifically. I will say, you know, Airbnb, HomeAway, all of these different sites, they are extremely price sensitive. because there's just so much volume of stock on there, there's just so many houses and rooms advertised, the markets tend to be quite micro-specific. So, you know, within LA, then you're within Santa Monica, then you're within a certain few streets. You know, how that is priced at different weeks, and certainly that's true in Nantucket. So you can't really just, how not to make money on Airbnb is just to whack it up there, put a price and just wait passively for things to happen. I think there is a perception that it's a totally passive way to make an income. And, you know, while it's definitely easier than working down a mine, if you want to do well at it as a business, you need to be involved. You need to call your tenants. You need to be available to them when things go wrong. You know, you need to price it correctly and sometimes competitively.
So basically you're saying I shouldn't have given Mark that point.
you won't take it back, though.
No,
you
should always give Mark points when it comes to finding a bargain. There's no one better.
Thank you, Tilly. My book, Bargain Fever, is out right now.
Tilly, have you heard of a service called Kid & Co, actually? While we're on the topic of Airbnb and family friendliness, it's specifically designed for exactly the things that you're talking about. Maybe you should put your homes on Kid & Co.
Kid & Co. I'm writing it down as we speak.
Yeah.
I have not, no.
It basically is Airbnb, but reduced just to family-friendly homes, and their criteria for that is very specific, but I think part of it is you need to have toys for the kids, you need to have child locks, you need to have baby gates, so on and so forth.
Yeah,
and
a cover the way on that, your pool.
Right. The way that Airbnb lists amenities, I think Kid & Co. goes much deeper on that in terms of what it offers for kids and age appropriateness. So I think that could
great.
Be a nice
That's
hit
great.
For you guys.
I'm sure there's going to be more of those coming because, you know, I mean, hotels are just very, very expensive for families and they're difficult.
Oh, yeah.
And this is a whole new world.
And house swapping, I think, could be a really interesting option, too, when you're talking about people who are of similar demographic groups and have similar family structures.
And
We've done that.
I love you for teeing me up about that because I was talking about house swapping always makes me think of the holiday. And when we think about the holiday...
Great film, come on.
Exactly. So, Tilly, if I say the word Christmas to you, tell us about how you will travel for Christmas, how Christmas is a travel thing for you.
Well, Christmas is always a travel thing for me because otherwise it would involve staying in Los Angeles, which has got to be the least Christmassy place, I think, after maybe Baghdad. And that might be harsh on Baghdad, I don't know. Never been there. You don't want to be here for Christmas. It's got lots of good things going for it. But for me, Christmas, I mean, maybe just growing up in England, Christmas is snow and carols and tradition. And it's one of the few things my husband and I, we have little in common, actually, despite our happy 25-year marriage. We love Christmas. We're both obsessed with it for different ways. So, yes, it's always traveling. It's usually back home to England. Not always. This year we're going to Pittsburgh, which is where my husband's from, and which I also love for Christmas, I have to say. It's snowy. It's incredibly kitsch.
Pittsburgh is cute. They really get
into it with the lights in a big way. So I'm all about sort of American Christmas. I can do the whole Charlie Brown thing as well. That's fine. But it has to be cold and festive.
But tell us, I know that you have a clever little source for amazing Christmas ornaments right on your doorstep. Where do you go? Where do you drive to?
Oh, so I know exactly what you're talking about. Yes, I drive to Solvang, beautiful Solvang in the Santa Ynez Valley, which is, I suppose, about half an hour past Santa Barbara. And it's an incredibly beautiful, very, very kitsch Danish town. It's a Danish settlement, so it's got all these sort of fake windmills all over the shop and Danish pastries the sort of size of small family cars, and it's just lovely in every way, beautiful scenery, but it has a fantastic Christmas shop there called the Yule Hus, I believe, and which has lots of Scandinavian Christmas ornaments but also sort of old school Americana ones. They sell beautiful old advent calendars, the paper kind without chocolate in, with lovely old pictures that you get in England. That is just fantastic. Yes, every year we go and do our Christmas shop in pretend Denmark, which is one of my favourite places.
I love that pretend Denmark is a place.
Yeah, you've got Jew among us interested in the Christmas shop, I have to say.
Oh, I love a good Christmas shop, especially in July. Talk about bargains. Seriously, Christmas shops in July. It's a whole chapter that you've missed, Mark.
I'm so sorry. Again, Bargain Fever out right now. I was going to say, you always carry one thing in your carry-on, like any proud expat Brit. What is your must-have in your carry-on? What do you never leave home without?
Well, I know I'm going to sound like Alan Partridge here, but it's a big mug. Got your big mug, Alan. I never leave home without a really big mug. And the one I usually take is the one which has a photo of my village, sort of poorly appliqued on the front. But the reason for having the big mug is because in America, and certainly on planes, American planes, but actually in America generally, they don't make tea with boiling water. They're amazing at coffee, they're amazing at all sorts of things, but they really are not very good at making a good cup of tea. They'll make it with hot water out of a tap, which is horrible, or they'll make it with boiling water, but in these tiny little cups that it sort of instantly goes cold.
Those drive me
bonkers.
And
then by the time you've added milk, it's freezing. So I try to give them a head start with my big mug.
So why does the big mug help? I mean, the temperature of the water is the same, right? Explain.
Well, yes, but however hot your water is, if you've got a little cup, it's going to get cold really quickly. And especially a little cup that opens up wide at the top. Again, Americans are also quite keen on those. A mug should be big and tall, like a sort of townhouse, a circular townhouse.
With a handle. A townhouse with a handle.
Yeah, so however hot it is, it will stay hotter. Hopefully, you'll be somewhere like a Virgin Atlantic flight where you can specify that you would like the water boiling. There might be a law against boiling water in case they spill it on you. I don't know.
Well, but, I'm just going to give you one of these.
Thank you.
Just because I really sympathize with the cold tea thing, especially on a freaking cold plane. Mm-hmm. There's nothing worse.
And also there's something I think having your own mug is a glimpse of home. I think there's something interestingly anchoring when you're, especially if you're a nervous flyer, something like a mug that is a piece of familiarity can be very anchoring in an unusual or nervous environment.
You need a good mug. Got your big mug, Alan.
Well, Telly, thank you so much. I just want to go to Solvang with you and buy my next advent calendar. Next time we're in LA, will you take me to Solvang?
I will take you to... You have no idea how much you're going to love Solvang. The advent calendars are just the start.
Oh, I think I do.
I'm going to tag along and get something for my Hanukkah bush.
You could come, Nikki. You could come. Yeah, and Telly, where can people... If people want to get in touch with you or follow you, where can they find you on social media?
On social media, they can find me on Facebook and also on my publisher Facebook page, which should be at Tilly Bagshaw, or they can just search for Murder at the Mill under St. Martin's Press, because that's my latest US release.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Dol.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, Nikki, hit me with it. How did Tilly score?
Tilly did very well. She got 3 points. 1 for 2 words that'll always get you an upgrade over the phone. 2 for something called realistic thinking to combat your fear of flying. And 3 for convincing me to pack something that seems very impractical on the surface, a big mug.
And also, who else got a point, Nikki?
Mark, you did. Yay! For helping everybody maximize their Airbnb listings. Congratulations.
I got a point. Very impressive.
This has been another episode of Travel Genius. I'm Nikki Eckstein.
And I'm Mark Elwood. Do you have a favorite travel tip or hack? Or do you have thoughts on one of the tips we discussed today? Please let us know.
You can call us at 646-324-3490. And maybe we'll even play your tip on the show. You can also find us on Twitter. I'm at Nikki Eckstein with 3 Ks and no Cs.
And I'm at Mark J. Elwood with a K and 2 Ls. And remember, that's 646-324-3490. And if you are a fan of Travel Genius, I hope you are, please take a moment to rate and review us. It really helps new listeners find.
This episode was produced by Topher Forges with help by Magnus Henriksen. Francesca Levy is Bloomberg's head of podcasts. Thanks for listening.